I'd like to turn your attention to the second book of Kings and, if not conclude, certainly add to this section of Elijah, the last part of Elijah. So, 2 Kings chapter 2. I'll read from the whole chapter, but I'll preach from verse 7 onwards. 2 Kings chapter 2, and I'll read from the beginning. And it came to pass, when the Lord was about to take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. Then Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. Now the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today?" And he said, "Yes, I know. Keep silent." Then Elijah said to him, "Elisha, stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me on to Jericho." And he said, "As the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So they went to Jericho. Now the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho came to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today?" So he said, "Yes, I know. Keep silent." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me onto the Jordan." But he said, "As the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. And 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood facing them at a distance while the two of them stood by the Jordan. Now Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water. And it was divided this way and that, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. And so it was, when they had crossed over, that Elijah said to Elisha, "Ask, what may I do for you before I am taken away from you?" I will pause there. So the first part of the chapter is really quite repetitive. We have a number of conversations which appear to be repetition. And what we have here is Elisha sticking with Elijah right to the very end. He's not going to tire of him. Now he's an old man and his earthly usefulness is nearly over. Neither is he going to be distracted or put off or grief-ridden when these 50 individuals keep coming out and reminding him that Elijah's days or perhaps hours are numbered. He's going to be with Elijah for as long as he possibly can. And in verse 7, to me at least, it was a relief that these 50 men don't repeat what the other groups of 50 men have been saying. We're told that the sons of the prophets, notice here that although Elijah may have looked upon his ministry as a failure, there are sons of the prophets gathering together. It might be that Elijah, of course, never saw what we might call revival in his day, and yet we can detect the signs of it. There is a new generation in Israel who is faithful to God. This time, instead of reminding Elisha that his master is to be taken, they stood facing them at a distance. They're merely watching. They know that this great man of God is to be taken. I imagine that the Lord shared that with Elijah, and word has got round that this man, possibly an old man, has not long to live, at least on the earth as we know it. Elijah takes his mantle and rolled it up and struck the water. This may have been a garment he wore over his shoulders, sometimes perhaps over his head, we're not too sure. And he strikes the water and he divides it. Elijah may not have long left on the earth, but he's certainly not planning to get his feet wet. He crosses the river in a most civilized fashion. And yet there is something significant here. The Jordan is going to be crossed. Of course, Israel has already crossed the Jordan a long time ago. Now, living where, when and where we do, we often kind of lump Old Testament times together, but it actually covers a long period of time. And for Elijah and Elisha, the children of Israel, under Joshua, crossing the Jordan, for them, it was a long time ago. It was an even longer time ago for us, but they may well have considered it to be ancient history. We consider them to be ancient history. But there is a reminder here, and there is a theme in this passage, that the God of the great men and women of the past is still around. And that, I think, will be a source of comfort for us today. The God who led the children of Israel into the promised land across the Jordan is still in business. But the land, of course, seems to be generally pagan. Oh, there are shoots of life and faithfulness. We have the sons of the prophets in this town and that. But there is great apostasy in the land. Many people are worshipping Baal, the disgusting fertility god. And yet there is a message here. God is still with them. God is still providing. God is still saving. And he strikes the water. Perhaps here a reminder of Moses also crossing the Red Sea, going even further back into Israelite history, and it was divided this way and that, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. Some of you know I enjoy reading and studying Christian history. I imagine sometimes it gets boring when I talk about it so much. But one thing it reminds me is that God has been faithful to his people for a long, long time. And we read of times in which God moved and poured forth his spirit in the past and revived his church. And we look at the times in which we live and we might be tempted to think, well, God's doesn't do anything like that anymore. And yet the message, I think, of this passage is that the God of Elijah is still there, even when Elijah is not. The God of Joshua is still there, even when Joshua is not. The God of Moses is still there, even when Moses is not. Having crossed, in verse 9, we read, and so it was when they had crossed over, that Elijah said to Elisha, ask, what may I do for you before I am taken away from you? Now in the first part of the chapter, Elijah appears to be fobbing him off. I need to go there, you wait here. And Elisha will have none of it. Here Elijah says, what can I do for you? And in one respect, we must ask, well, what were the available options? You visit somebody's house and they say, would you like a drink? And you say, what have you got? You might end up with water. What actually could Elijah do for him? What does he have in his pockets which might be useful to a future prophet? Probably nothing. There is a sense, I think, in which Elisha is being tested in chapter 2. Elijah says, I have to go there, you stay here. Elisha says no, but he gets no rebuke. Here is a younger man who stays faithful to the older man. Here is a faithful student who sticks with his teacher and his master to the very end. And perhaps as an acknowledgement of that, Elijah says, what can I do for you? Perhaps this too is a test. Think of when the Lord appeared to Solomon. What do you want? Will it be gold? Will it be victory on the battlefield? Will it be prestige? He asked to be wise, to discern, and God gave him everything else for free. Perhaps there is a further test here in verse 9. What can I do for you? Occasionally in scripture, Psalm, off memory, Psalm 32 might be one of them. It talks about God giving people the desire of their heart. And of course, those who truly love the Lord, they don't want the cheap baubles of this world. They generally ask for things which God already wants to give them. I don't really know what Elisha's available options were. But his answer is a double portion of your spirit upon me. Some have interpreted that to mean, I want to be twice as good as you. In one respect, that would be a compliment. You're great. I want to be even greater. I don't think, though, that is what it does mean. It might be an acknowledgement from Elisha, I'm not half the man that you are. I need more of you to carry on your work. Do you ever feel perhaps overwhelmed by what you're called to do? Do you ever feel unqualified, unfit? You can think of other people that should be doing this, and yet here you are doing it. And you get down on your knees and you say, Lord, I need all the help I can get. Such a prayer God delights to honour. The one who does not need God's help, who does not seek God's help, does not deserve God's help. I think Elisha's response is an acknowledgement that he is a weak and feeble man. And he cannot continue the preaching and the encouragement and the faithful ministry of Elijah unless he has even more of Elijah than Elijah has, if you can work that out. I don't think it's referring to he wants the actual spirit or the soul of Elijah to be upon him. Some of you may be aware that there is a practice which takes place in our own time in which people find graves of people, of church leaders in the past, and they lay on the grave. It's called grave soaking. And the idea is that you can absorb the spirits of Smith Wigglesworth or whoever. Of course, it's utterly foolish because I don't think the spirit is kind of there. That's the whole point of Christianity. You know, you're not just dead. And in the highly unlikely event that A, I'm buried in our graveyard, I think it might be full by then, and B, anybody thinks it worthwhile laying on my grave, you can rest assured there will be a fists rising from the ground, giving them exactly what I think of that particular practice. He's not asking for the ghosts or the soul of Elijah to be upon him. That is utterly obnoxious and contrary to what the text is teaching. Some have suggested it refers to the Spirit of God. The Spirit of God was upon you. I need the Spirit of God to be upon me. Possibly. We know from Deuteronomy 21 that the firstborn received a double portion. Now, chapter 2 makes it clear. There are a number of prophets in Israel at this time. And perhaps Elisha is saying, if I'm going to continue your work, I have to be your spiritual firstborn. I want to be your heir. I don't want to be you. I can't be you. But I want to be your heir. I want to pick up where you have left off. I want to take the baton from your old hand into my younger hand and keep running with it. I want to keep on running the race that you started. I want to challenge those wicked kings. I want to deal with the prophets of Baal with the same courage and faithfulness and tenacity as you did. But I'm a weak man. I need more of it. I want to be your heir. I suspect that is the meaning of it. And yet Elijah says, you've asked a hard thing. It's a hard thing because it wasn't really in Elijah's gift. Who appointed Elijah? God. And only God can appoint Elijah's heir. Nevertheless, if you see me in verse 10, when I am taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so. Elijah is not going to make a promise he cannot keep. And in one respect, he could be spirited away, and Elijah could not ask him any awkward questions. But Elijah has such integrity, he says only God can give you what you've asked for. It happened as they continued on and talked. I would love to know what they continued to talk about. Suddenly, a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire. Now, I've never preached on this passage, but it's one of the few passages which even non-religious people may have a degree of familiarity. A chariot of fire with horses of fire and separated the two of them. Though I still picture my Sunday school book with Elijah inside a fiery chariot waving at Elisha and speeding off. Perhaps the translations differ, but Elijah went up in a whirlwind. Now I'm sure there is a way of a fiery chariot ascending and a whirlwind. I don't know. I can't really picture the scene. But I think there is some significance here. This chariot of fire is not just an exciting kind of taxi to take him up to heaven. A chariot, of course, is a weapon of war. And there is a war being fought between good and evil. Between those who stand for truth and those who stand for a false god. And Elijah, who has fought so many battles, it is appropriate and off he goes in his chariot. A very interesting passage, because unless it's metaphorical, I think it's literal, he doesn't die. Like Enoch. God took him. We know that Elijah appears in the New Testament to the Lord on the Mount of Transfiguration. Although he appeared with Moses, and Moses did die. It's a very interesting passage for which I don't have concrete answers, but God determined that this prophet would be assumed into heaven. Perhaps anticipating New Testament teaching. Death is a defeated foe. And I believe that those of us who are alive on the earth when the Lord returns, we shall go to meet him in the air. But even if we are not that generation, and so far, no generation of Christian has been that generation. Yeah, your body you will here leave behind, but you will not be. You will go up to be with Christ, which is better by far. Sometimes when believers have died in the past, they've made little comments about they can see angels coming for them. I don't know. Perhaps they do, perhaps they don't. It might be there is a fiery chariot up in heaven and with your name on it. I hope it doesn't come down quite yet. I don't know. But Elijah is separated from Elisha by this fiery transportation. And the whirlwind takes him up to heaven. Of course, that reminded me of the ascension of the Lord Jesus Christ. It was visible. He could be seen going up. This is, of course, one of the most spectacular events in Scripture. And yet Elisha's response to it seems to be one of grief. Elisha saw it and he cried out, "My father, my father." He's not just a student of Elijah. He's not just a servant or a disciple. He sees him as his father. Having seen this ascension, of course, he knows that the request he made has been granted. The fact that he now calls him father and says twice could, of course, be his way of communicating. He has been appointed by God, the heir of Elijah. My father, the double portion is granted. The chariot of Israel and its horsemen. Is he calling Elijah the chariot of Israel? Is he describing this fiery chariot as the chariot of Israel and its horsemen? He cries out. But it would have been a great comfort to a man who has been left behind, a man who is part of a minority faith, even in that nation, to know that the God whom he serves is a warrior God. The Lord is a warrior. There's no contradiction there with the Lord being our shepherd. A shepherd does not just guide the sheep to lovely pastures and clear waters. He carries a staff to beat off the wolves. I mentioned before Sunday school. I can't remember the tune. I won't give you a rendition. In fact, it doesn't sound very theologically deep. But I'm sure I used to sing one. Our God is a great big God. Well, the God of Elijah is a strong God, a great God. Dare I say, a big God. So he saw him no more. He's been blessed with this wonderful vision. And yet, let us not forget the fact that his spiritual father has been taken. And Elisha might have thought, but Lord, we were stronger together. But Lord, there is still more I could have learned. Lord, there is more I should have learned. Lord, did you have to take him this day? Would another week have sufficed, or another month, or another year? Yet somehow, God uses the taking of the one for the commissioning of another. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. High and lifted up. It's often through the tears of grief we see spiritual things more clearly. He took hold of his own clothes and he tore them. Now there are a couple of explanations for that. The first one might be it is a standard ancient expression of grief. You tear your clothes. We might don black, they tore their clothes. It might tie in, my father, the double portion. But we also ought to explain the end of verse 12 by considering the beginning of verse 13. He also took up the mantle of Elijah. He tears his own clothes, but he picks up what Elijah left behind. Elijah, presumably, went in that whirlwind or the chariot, I'm not sure, fully dressed. But he left behind the mantle. Did he forget to take it? He no longer needed it. In one respect, it was his badge of office. It might have been made of goat's hair where he got this reputation for being a hairy man, I don't know. But he leaves it behind and Elisha picks it up. It might be that he tears off his own old clothing and puts on Elijah's mantle. I am, after all, the heir of Elijah. What Elijah dropped, I pick up. What Elijah no longer must wear, I shall wear in his stead. And I will tear my own clothing, as it were, to make room for it. He went back and stood by the bank of the Jordan. I don't know if much time elapsed between the end of verse 13 and the beginning of verse 14. He knows that when Elijah crossed the Jordan and he struck it with a mantle, the waters parted. But that was Elijah, and he was a really great prophet. What will Elisha do? Oh, he saw the vision, and he's got the mantle. But the mantle is not a magic wand. It's God
who performs miracles, not bits of cloth or goat skin.
I know some people sometimes wear crosses about their necks because they think it might protect them from this or from that. A cross around your neck protects you from nothing. The real cross upon which Christ hung can protect you from hell itself. Now, if wearing a cross is a reminder to you of that, then wear it. And if in godless secular Britain you want to make a statement of faith, then wear it. But don't think that that jewellery can protect you. It can't. Don't think that holding a Bible gives you special powers. It doesn't. Read it. Read it. And believe it. The mantle Elisha picked up has no magical powers. But here, if the chapter is a test for Elisha, here comes another test. Will the waters part for him? Or does he need to find a boat? He took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him. It's as though perhaps God in his providence arranged for it to fall. He struck the water and said, "Where is the God of Elijah?" What a strange question. You might answer, well, he's up in heaven. Where do you think he is? Furthermore, we know that Elijah was taken up to God. Elisha is not asking a question of geography. He's really crying out, will the God of Elijah be the God of Elisha? Will he be with the Son as he was with the Father? Will he be with Junior as he was with Senior? He's almost saying, God, are you still there? And are you there for me? Are you there with me? Because you've just taken the best man away. And I'm the only one left. I'm not as great as he, but will you be with me? And he strikes the water, and guess what? It was divided this way and that. To answer the question, where is the God of Elijah? It is, he's there with you, Elisha. In fact, Elisha, you could stop calling him the God of Elijah now. You can call him the God of Elisha. You can call him my God. You can call him my Father. And there's a little detail there at the end, which doesn't seem necessary, but I think it is. And Elisha crossed over. He's going back. Now we know there's a group of characters waiting for him. And I'll not get onto it today. They're quite annoying. Don't be surprised if when you're riding high and you're close with the Lord, you've spent time in his word and you've been blessed Do not be surprised if within approximately 38 seconds, the Lord's people annoy you. They do, and they will. And another time, we'll look at the 50. Evidently, they don't think he's gone to heaven. And they waste Elisha's time. But that aside, Elisha crossed over. Why? Because there's work to do. He's not just to wear the mantle and look the part. He's not just to go whacking rivers and seeing the waters part. He's to part the waters because he has to cross over because God's glory must be defended. The God of Elijah is with him. I made a little point before, which I'd like to come back to. We are living in days not dissimilar to those of Israel at the time of Elijah and Elisha. I don't make direct comparisons. I don't think God has ever made a covenant with Great Britain. But spiritually, I could make the number up. I'm not going to. But churches close every month. Lots of them. And of those that don't, they might as well. Many of them. And we might ask, where is the God of Elijah? Where is the God of Wesley? Where is the God of Whitfield? Where is the God of Wycliffe? Where is the God of Cranmer? Well, the God of all the great men and women of the past is our God. And sometimes he works in ways we cannot understand. Sometimes he will be silent. Sometimes his activity cannot be discerned. But yesterday, today, forever, he is the same. And we know that God sometimes takes people we could still do with being here. But that's not the point of the passage. The point of the passage is that Elisha picked up the mantle and he used it. I look back at Elisha and I think, what a great man of God. Elisha at this moment is not thinking that. It might be that in thousands of years' time, Christians already in heaven will look at the battles you faced, the challenges you overcome, and they will be as inspired by it as perhaps we are by Elisha. Probably nobody will write a book about it. It certainly won't be included in the scriptures. But friends, the God of Elijah is the God of Elisha, and the God of Elisha is our God.